Hey everybody, welcome into the back room. I'm Andy Ostroy. I am so looking forward to today's conversation with author Sarah McCammon, whose new book, The Exvangelicals, is out. And we're going to talk to her about that and more. But first, thanks for tuning in today. We appreciate you listening, and we'd love to hear your comments. So email us at backroomandy@gmail.com and or post on our social media, and we'll read some feedback next time. And if you like the podcast, please follow or subscribe and rate and review. And you'll be notified every time we post a new episode. All right, let's get to the big news of the week. The first thing is Trump in the election. Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, is going to be at Mar-a-Lago today, kissing the ring or the ass or whatever you want to call it that he's going to be kissing.
Well, essentially, they're building on the big lie. They're going to announce something about election integrity. And apparently he's going to beg Trump to let him give aid to Ukraine, which is incomprehensibly pathetic.
Well, we know Trump loves being begged, so that could work.
No, it won't work because he's a Russian agent.
And are you suggesting there's actual continuity to his strategy?
He
has a core belief system?
No, it has nothing to do with belief. It has to do with grift. He gets a lot more money out of Putin than he does out of Johnson.
That would require him to think beyond the next 10 seconds.
He's beholden to Putin more than Johnson.
This could be another bet.
Oh, I'll bet.
So Donald Trump this Monday is going to be in court in the New York hush money trial. Jury selection will begin on Monday. Trump has been desperately trying to have that trial delayed or dismissed on various grounds. Like he filed motions to change the venue. He filed motions based on the gag order. He filed motions based on pretrial publicity, which he says is going to taint the jury, when in fact he's the one that's doing all the pretrial publicity.
Yeah, I mean, nothing matters because his base just sees this as a witch hunt. And as we learned recently, the amount of money he spent from his donors is amounting to $95,000 per day in legal fees. And that buys you a lot of bogus motions.
I mean, I've said this before, I'm going to say it again. I really wish my fellow Democrats would stop minimizing the significance of this trial. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess perspective is very, very important. You know, when it's 7, 8, 9, 10 months ago, and everyone's like, God, I wish this trial was not the one that's good. I wish. And now all of a sudden we're sitting here in April, and this is like the only one that's happening. And now it's like a whole different thing. It's like, thank God that Alvin Bragg is bringing this fucker to justice on Monday. And hopefully by the beginning of June, he is going to be a convicted felon. And all the polls, even among the not the most loyal Trumpers, but a good chunk of the Republicans out there, have said that's a game changer for them. If he's a convicted felon, they cannot vote for him. So this is huge. Besides the fact that it's not about hush money, it's about election interference. And anyone who believes Donald Trump's bullshit about, you know, I was just trying to spare my wife some pain. You know, this is a guy who fucked a porn star while his wife was pregnant. I think, you know, him caring about his beloved wife went out the window a few years ago.
Good point there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad the case is happening, but I don't think it'll have that much impact on his election in terms of people deciding not to vote for him. I think that's baked in the cake now, and I don't think very few people's minds are going to change.
We shall see. So also this week, on Monday, Trump issued his long-awaited, much-anticipated statement on abortion.
Many people have asked me what my position is on abortion and abortion rights, especially since I was proudly the person responsible for the ending of something that all legal scholars, both sides, wanted and, in fact, demanded be ended. Roe v. Wade. They wanted it ended. It must be remembered that the Democrats are the radical ones on this position because they support abortion up to and even beyond the 9th month. The concept of having an abortion in the later months and even execution after birth, and that's exactly what it is. The baby is born, the baby is executed after birth, is unacceptable, and almost everyone agrees with that. My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint, the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state. Many states will be different. Many will have a different number of weeks, or some will have more conservative than others, and that's what they will be. At the end of the day, this is all about the will of the people. Now it's up to the states to do the right thing. Like Ronald Reagan, I am strongly in favor of exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother. You must follow your heart on this issue, but remember, you must also win elections to restore our culture.
Jen, how many MAGAs do we have listening to this, this podcast these days?
I hate to break it to you, Andy.
None?
It's none. It's so partisan these days.
Well, just in case there are some Republicans listening, Trump is talking to you like you're a moron. I'm just throwing it out there. So let's break this thing down, okay? First of all, Democrats wanted an end to Roe v. Wade. Are you fucking kidding me?
He loves saying both sides.
Yeah. And can someone please show me one instance where a baby was aborted after it was born, that it was executed, that a baby was born, they slapped its ass, wah, 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 and the doctors looked at each other and were like, let's choke it
to death now.
Let's kill this little fucker.
But some babies are ugly enough to kill.
Oosh, he said that, folks. I didn't. I love all babies.
If you took a poll of MAGA followers, I would guesstimate that 93.5% believe that that's real.
I'd go with 91%.
I might go with 93. Not 93.5, 93. Baby executing. And so whenever Donald Trump speaks about abortion, he puts his foot in his mouth and implodes his own campaign, just ruins it for the GOP. They're all fucking scrambling. Every one of them is scrambling. He's flip-flopped. He proudly brags that he's the one who killed Roe, should go to the states, but then Arizona, which we're going to talk about in a second, the Supreme Court upholds a Civil War era near total ban on abortion, and he's like, no, that's too far, that's too much. So, like, is it up to the states? Is it not up to the states? They can't find their place. They know they love the uterus. They know they want to control it. They just don't know how to do so without it costing them elections. This is their problem. Love the uterus, lose the election.
That's a new Biden tagline.
President Biden, if you're listening, take it. It's free.
I have to say that all women, I'm going to speak for all women like the way he speaks for all people. All women like nothing more than an old white man telling us how we feel, how we think, and what we should be doing with our bodies. Thank you, President Trump.
Yeah. But, you know, look. There was one thing in there that it really touched me deeply because I mean, I'm not even sure I can say this without getting very emotional, teary. All right, I'm just going to say it. Look, when a rapist comes out supporting exceptions for rape, there's nothing more touching than that. Seriously, think about that. Because he knows. Who knows more about the trauma caused by rape than a rapist, right?
I hadn't really thought about it from that point of view before. Yeah, that's a good point.
That's real big of him. And then his last thing that he said was about winning elections and restoring our culture. What culture is that? Is that a Jewish culture? Is the 3% of Jews now going to be like the 1% of the rich? Like we're going to, the 3%ers, we're going to control everything? We Jews?
I think he's talking about 1950s ideas of old white people culture.
Maybe. Black people knew their place?
Of course. And women knew their place.
And gay people were in the closet.
And women didn't have credit cards.
There were no gay
people. Just saying.
Women were barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen where they belong. Okay?
Maybe pregnant. They were wearing heels. Come on. Who are we kidding?
And what about Hispanics? Back in the fields, right? Mm. Yes. We must restore our culture. Hey, Gewalt. All right. So what happened after he put out his statement? The pro-national ban crowd went nuts, right? Everybody went crazy. Nobody was happy with Trump because he didn't go far enough. He went too far. Lindsey Graham came out.
Yes.
Lindsey Graham came out and said, I'm very disappointed. Trump didn't support a national ban.
And then he licked Trump's balls.
Well, let's back up a little. Now,
Wait. Can you please bring out Lindsey Graham so he could say it in his own word?
I happen to have Lindsey Graham right here.
Thank you.
Okay, Lindsey, how did you feel when Donald Trump attacked you after that? I just want to say for the last 4 years, maybe even longer, I have been rimming Donald Trump like you can't imagine. I have licked, kissed, sucked, you name it, anything that could be done on an ass, I have done it. Oh my God, I do declare. And then to see him trash me like that publicly, just because I disagree with him. So yeah, I guess maybe shame on me. You know, he did put my phone number out there, which actually was a blessing because I got a lot of really fun phone calls. I met some really yummy young men. All right, thanks, Senator. Arizona just did the Democrats a huge fucking favor. And why do I say that? Because after Dobbs, after Roe was overturned, the Republican Party has lost everything. Everything. Every special election, major election, even though they took the House, they took it by 3 or 4 votes when they were supposed to have a red wave of 40 to 60 seats. So this week, the state Supreme Court upheld a 160-year-old near-total ban. A ban that was created before Arizona was even a fucking state. Okay? No exceptions except to save the mother's life. Oh, that's so heartwarming. Mandating 2 to 5 years in prison for anyone aiding and abetting someone getting an abortion. Now, the state's attorney general, Chris Mays, came out and said her office won't prosecute women or doctors, but she's up for re-election. She could lose in the fall, and if she does, then...
Well, also, this creates major problems for doctors. They really can't do it, even if she's not going to enforce
sure.
it.
Sure, they're not going to roll the dice on
Well,
that.
Also, they're not going to be insured. They're breaking the law.
Yeah. So the law goes into effect 2 weeks, but here's the other thing. The Supreme Court also said it will allow a ballot measure in November. So, like other states we've seen, the voters are going to decide in November what happens in Arizona with regard to abortion. And if history is going to repeat itself, not only will abortion be enshrined in the state's constitution, but it's going to cost Republicans, most likely Carrie Lake, who's running against Ruben Gallego. This was a gift to Ruben Gallego. But Carrie Lake, she supported this ban in the past, and now she's like, oh, this is too far. This is going too far. They are so scared because they're starting to realize after the fact. I don't know why they just don't, you know, do these things in the first place, but they do them, and then they're like reminded of the backlash because, you know, 80% of the country is pro-choice and wants people out of, you know, old white men out of their vaginas and uteruses.
But they unleash the beast.
I mean, this is the old
seriously
dog catching the car. I mean, former governor Doug Ducey even came out and said the judges went too far. The two of the four judges that ruled in it are appointees of him, and that's why they're so awful. And now suddenly he's surprised that they would make this ruling.
Yeah, look, I say let's take the short-term pain, bring it on, because this is suicide for them. It's absolute suicide. They are 1,000,000% dead wrong on this issue. They have been for years. They rolled the dice. They were giddy. They waited decades to overturn Roe, and they have grossly underestimated the anger and the power of America's women and the dudes who love them. All right, let's go to our winners. And
the who, the her.
My winner, the EPA, for limiting pollution from chemical plants. The new regulation, the first one in 20 years, is aimed at reducing the risk of cancer for people who live close to plants emitting toxic chemicals. My loser, Arizona Supreme Court abortion ruling from 1864.
My winner will definitely be Biden's chances of winning Arizona, given the ruling from the Arizona Supreme Court. And my loser today, I read J.D. Vance's piece in today's New York Times, his Russian propaganda piece against helping Ukraine. This further cements the fact that the majority of the GOP are Putin cronies.
Let me start with my loser, a panicked election-denying Arizona MAGA Senate candidate, Carrie Lake, who's flipped and now claims she opposes the state's draconian abortion ban after supporting it. My winner, Arizona Democratic Senate candidate, Ruben Gallego, who likely was just handed a victory by the Arizona Supreme Court. All right, it's time for the weekly rant. I might lose a couple of friends on this one, but so be it. Because I need to address this totally destructive practice of the protest vote. You know, when voters want to send a message to a candidate because they don't like a specific action and or a particular policy. And that message often comes in the form of either a vote for a third-party candidate, or not voting at all. both of which are terrible choices, which do nothing to make America and the world a better place, and do nothing to affect the kind of real change these voters want. So let's for a second put aside the holier-than-thou, smarter-than-you, more righteous and principled-than-you attitude that is usually associated with the protest vote and its prosecutors. Let's just focus instead on simple means and ends. No one is impressed with your protest vote. You're not cool, and no one deems you a hero. To the contrary, we see you as foolish and misguided, and actually contributing to perpetuating and even worsening the very problems you've been protesting about in the first place. Because your protest vote, especially in this particularly critical upcoming presidential election, will achieve nothing except hand the country over to a monster who is going to eventually make you regret that obnoxious, self-destructive protest vote. Because Donald J. Trump is a pathologically lying, sexist, racist, anti-Semitic, Hitler and Nazi-obsessed, homophobic, xenophobic, twice impeached, four-time indicted, corrupt, serial law-breaking, democracy-raping, dictator-wannabe, sexual-abusing, rapist, right-wing, extremist, sociopath, who is hell-bent on weaponizing the government to exact revenge on his opponents while shredding the Constitution, alienating our allies, and enabling our enemies. Trust me, you think President Biden's Israel-Gaza policy upsets you? Just wait until Trump throws his undying loyalty and support to his Israeli spirit animal, Bibi Netanyahu. Just wait till you see how Palestinians are treated by these two cruel, tone-deaf, self-serving criminals. Just wait till he strips you of more reproductive rights, more voter rights, appoints more extremist conservative Supreme Court justices, bans Muslims and stops immigration, except from those very fine white people from countries he loves like Sweden and Denmark. Or before he implements registrations and camps and mass deportations and incites more violence, or invokes the Insurrection Act and starts shooting protesters on the streets, or orders the military to assassinate his opponents. You know, the kind of shit dictators do. And you know what? The threats from Trump aren't hypothetical, because these are all things he's either done in his first term and or has promised to do in his next. So when Trump tells you who he is and what he's going to do, believe him. So put your big boy and girl pants on and grow the fuck up. You have two choices on the menu, Trump or Biden. Do what adults do. Suck it up and make the mature, responsible choice. You want to protest? Write a letter to the editor. But come November, do the right thing. And don't hand the keys to the Oval Office over to someone who's going to ruin your life in ways you're simply not thinking about right now because you're too busy celebrating your protest vote awesomeness. It's time for Sarah McCammon. She is a national political correspondent for NPR and co-host of the NPR Politics Podcast. Her work focuses on political, social, and cultural divides in America, including the intersections of politics and religion, reproductive rights, and the conservative movement. She is also a frequent guest host for NPR news magazines and has appeared on the BBC, CNN, PBS, and MSNBC. During the 2016 election cycle, Sarah was NPR's lead political reporter assigned to the Donald Trump campaign and previously reported for NPR member stations in Georgia, Iowa, and Nebraska. Her new book is The Exvangelicals: Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Sarah, welcome into the back room.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first off, I am really honored because I am now looking at the room that Room Raider gave the perfect score. 10 out of 10.
Finally.
I want to congratulate you on that because that is more important than anything these days.
Yeah, I've gotten a few Room Raider scores over the years, and this is the first time I got a 10-10, and I was very happy. Thank you. It's a big moment.
You can't get more than that. And I love the way those guys explain the rationale. Like, I see now the one carefully placed copy of your book.
Yeah, because I had two for my last appearance.
Nah, you don't want to go with 10. You don't want to go with two.
Two is gratuitous.
That's going to bring it down to 8, for sure. So, and then the other thing we have to get out of the way before we talk about your book is the other book. Have you gotten your Trump 3-in-1 Bible yet?
Not yet.
So there's a chance.
I've written about it on my Substack, but I have not purchased one.
What is your, just give me your quick take on that $60 version of craziness.
So Yeah, what I wrote on, I have a longer essay on this on my Substack, which is called Off the Air, A mm-hmm. Journalist's After Hours Thoughts. But my essential take is that Trump, when he did that, was, I listened to the 3 or 4 minute video where he stood up and held the Bible. Everybody talked about the Bible and, you know, what it looked like and what it had in it, all these other documents. But one, that it's a fusion, obviously, of Christianity and politics, a very sort of plays into sort of Christian nationalist themes, obviously. But I think like what's less obvious is the way he talked about it. He said, he held up that Bible and he said, Christianity is under siege. We have to bring Christianity, I'm paraphrasing this mm-hmm. part, but we have to bring Christianity back. We have to bring the Bible back, and the Bible is going to help us do that. Okay. It's a pretty close paraphrase. And this to me, it echoes what I heard growing up in evangelical circles for my whole life, which is this idea that America is truly a Christian nation, designed to be Christian, doesn't work without Christianity, set apart, specially called by God. Anything that goes wrong is a product of falling away from that sort of glorious history. Of course, a lot of that ignores racial injustice and many other things that were also part of the fabric of our nation's founding. Mm-hmm. But when Trump says, even when he says, I think, make America great again, for some evangelicals, it taps into that narrative in a way.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's a really interesting and important point, because, and especially with make America great again, for who? Like, it wasn't great for a lot of people. The era that he looks back on and his followers look back on as the era that we want to get back to weren't great for minorities and Jews and women and gays. The whole thing is a mess. So the book is called Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Congrats on the book. You're everywhere.
Thank you.
It's everywhere, as it should be, because it's a really important subject, especially now and especially heading towards a very, very critical election. So the ex-evangelicals, that's a great term. How long was that term, just as a word, floating around in your head?
Well, from what I understand, it seems to have been coined around 2015 or 16 by Blake Chastain, who is a podcaster and writer who started sort of talking about some of these themes. Just, I think, before the 2016 election is kind of when he began talking about them more vocally and started a podcast by the name Ex-Evangelical. He also has a Substack where he writes about kind of post-evangelicalism. And but I first came across this term through my reporting for NPR. I was doing a story just before the 2016 election about the evangelical response to the Access Hollywood video, where, of course, Trump bragged about grabbing women by the vagina, for lack of a better word. We had to have a long conversation about what we could say about that on the radio. And so I had done a lot of reporting on the white evangelical movement and the evangelical response to Trump. You know, would they support him? Would they not? And all the efforts that his campaign had made to sort of win over and solidify evangelical support. And so I did this piece talking to evangelical women about how they felt about this video and their movement's response to it. And one of the women said, you know, some of us are using this word ex-evangelical instead of evangelical. We just feel like evangelicalism, it doesn't align with who we are anymore. Mm-hmm. And I'm paraphrasing. But so I started paying attention to that word. I started looking around online to kind of see what conversations were being had. And over the next several years, while I was, you know, reporting on lots of other stuff, I just kind of started paying attention to ex-evangelical Facebook groups and sort of there's a lot of ex-evangelical adjacent stuff. There's this whole conversation around religious deconstruction, which, you know, is a term that was popularized by Jacques Derrida some years ago. And I don't think it means exactly what he meant by it, but people use it as a way to talk about kind of rethinking their faith, mm-hmm. And re-examining it, evangelical and otherwise. But a lot of it is around evangelical spaces. So I started paying attention to those conversations, their podcasts, their TikTok influencers, Instagram influencers, YouTubers, all kinds of people having discussions generally around these themes of like, what does it mean to grow up evangelical? Maybe take a closer look at it. Some of the things you were taught, whether it's about science or about politics, for sure, or about sex and sort of, you know, go, does this align with what I think or does it align with reality? And for a lot of people, particularly of my generation, I'm in my early 40s, so some are a little younger, some are a little older. But a lot of people who grew up in what was really a robust evangelical subculture, you know, in the 80s and 90s and a little bit after, where there was just a whole universe of media and books and movies and TV shows for evangelical young people. For a lot of us, it's meant really kind of having to pull back the layers, learn things we weren't taught in maybe Christian school or homeschool, and do a lot of soul searching. And so that the book is a product of like this really unexpected intersection, I guess, between my personal background, having gone through a lot of that process myself when I was much younger, and then ending up, you know, as a journalist in my professional life, covering some of these themes.
Mm-hmm. So your grandfather serves as sort of a very loving bookend. You open and close the book with him. He clearly was a major influence and source of inspiration for you throughout your life. Tell us a little bit about him and why he was that way for you.
I grew up in Kansas City, the 80s and 90s, deeply, deeply enmeshed in evangelical culture, evangelical subculture. My whole world was my church, my Christian school. And I didn't know very many people who weren't evangelicals. And we believed that, you know, to go to heaven, you had to have a personal relationship with Jesus. You had to have prayed a prayer of salvation and accepted Jesus into your heart, is how we would put it. And that you had to share that with other people or they would not go to heaven. They would go to hell. And so, but as I write about, like, there weren't a whole lot of people to share that with in my world because everybody I knew was pretty much an evangelical Christian, except a few members of my extended family. And my grandpa was sort of the chief symbol throughout my childhood of, you know, the non-believer, because we were, you know, we were always talking or frequently talking about, you know, how we needed to pray for him when we would see him, which wasn't a whole lot, but we saw him on holidays, sometimes other occasions. We would, you know, be told to kind of be on our best behavior. We had to try to win him over to Jesus. And so I felt a lot of concern for him growing up and a lot of pressure to proselytize to him. And then I also talk about this in the book. You know, when I got a little older, I discovered that he had, after my grandmother passed away, he had come out as gay. And, you know, this was in the 80s. This was like the height of the AIDS crisis. Mm-hmm. This was a time when my parents, you know, the moral majority was on the rise. My parents were deeply enmeshed in the Christian right. And so his existence just created this foil for me, for everything that I was being taught. Like, he was this great source of concern and prayer and proselytization, but he was also this really accomplished, successful person. You know, he was a neurosurgeon and very active in the Kansas City's arts community, and really an exemplary person in so many ways. And yet he was like the symbol of everything we were supposed to be concerned about and kind of pushing against. So for me, in retrospect, that really forced me to contend with difference in a way that I don't think I would have otherwise in that environment.
And for lack of a better term, how much of a role did he play in your own deconstruction?
I think it was really significant. I mean, for a lot of my childhood, it was, the focus was on trying to make him like me.
Mm-hmm.
But I talk about, I had a couple of assignments in high school and in college, Christian college, where I was, you know, to my teacher's credit, I'm not sure what the objective was for all those assignments, but the objective or the assignment was to talk to somebody who had a different point of view and interact with it in some way and try to understand their worldview and maybe respond to it. And, you know, being forced to really unpack his worldview. And I reached out to him. I share some of that correspondence in the book where we talked about, I asked him about his beliefs. And, I think I found that I had built up some strawmen in my mind about what he really thought. You know, he was actually much more open to possibility of spirituality and the existence of God than I thought. And I don't mean to, you know, criticize people who are atheists, but I think I just assumed that he was adamantly anti-religion and anti, you know, it, like sort of had that he was in this posture of being opposed to everything that we stood for. And he really wasn't. He was just not sure about things and not willing and quite comfortable with just not knowing all the answers to the universe. And so it was interesting for me to hear from the horse's mouth what he actually thought. And, you know, when I looked back on those letters, it'd been actually a long time since I'd read them. When I was writing the book, I revisited them, and it was really instructive for me and actually really inspiring to just read his really beautiful prose and think about how he had wrestled with those questions that I'd wrestled with in a very different way. But there were other things too. Mm-hmm. You know, there were many other things. I think I talk about some of, I really kind of organized the book around various themes of cognitive dissonance or tension points, things that I, and I think a lot of other evangelical kids have had to reckon with when it comes to how we think about, you know, all of those themes like science and politics and sexuality mm-hmm. and so forth. And it's certainly religious difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also write about your friend Sina in college, who I think you were a Senate page with, and
right,
he had
right.
you and him had a discussion where he, I think, said something to you like, am I going to hell because I don't believe in what you believe or others believe, and I don't have the same God, because he was a Muslim, I believe. And mm-hmm. And then there was also a professor that brought in a guest speaker who was Jewish. And so it seems like you had a lot of these forces in your life that started to present an alternative way of thinking about the very subject of salvation and who gets the good ride versus who may not get a ride at all to the happy place. So those things must have been very powerful to you coming from the background you came from.
Yeah, because I was taught that, again, that we had to sort of really try to persuade the whole world to be like us. And I found that kind of exhausting. Especially when you're like a little kid and you haven't really lived much or done much. And, you know, you're handed this whole set of things that you're told you really must believe. Like, you must believe them. The explicit message is you must believe them to go to heaven and to live a good life and to please God. But the implicit message is you also have to believe them in order to be part of the community. You mm-hmm. have to believe them to be part of us.
Right.
And that's enforced in a lot of different ways that are often very subtle, but very powerful. You know, you ask the wrong question and and people start to say, you know, I'm going to pray for you. and it's like, there's a sense that you're, you know, you don't want to teeter too close to that edge. If anyone's read, we read Jonathan Edwards, you know, the famous Puritan revivalist preacher, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. We read that in Christian school. And it's like this very scary story about like a spider over a pit of fire about to fall in. That was like, that's you. Like, you're about to fall into the hands of an angry God who will destroy you for all of eternity if you don't get it right. And I found that so terrifying. You know, I mean, I believed, I was told that I was saved because I had prayed this prayer. And I was always worrying about whether I believed it enough and whether I was doing it right. And I started to worry, you know, I became aware even that there were other Christians, let alone non-Christians, but like other Christians, Catholics and mainline Protestants and all these other traditions that believe things differently than we did. And we weren't even sure if they were saved. And it became like this really overwhelming sense that like God had made all of these people, and like most of them were like literally damned or going to be. And that just increasingly didn't add up for me, you know, and it started with my grandpa and it continued with other people that you mentioned that I met along the way. And I, you know, there are whole traditions out there of like Christian universalism. I've been like studying about the founding fathers' beliefs because that's so in contention, you know, but, and a lot of them, not a lot of them, some of them were universalists, which I think is fascinating. This idea that like everybody ultimately ends up in heaven. And I, you know, I don't know what I believe, but like, I think that's a really beautiful idea if you believe in God. Like, the idea that God like made the whole world and ultimately it's all going to be okay is to me like a really beautiful vision of God. And I think that throughout my life, I've just been driven by this desire to like include other people not that I always do it well or fully, but like a desire to do that. And also just a sense that being expected to have it all figured out and then share that figured outness with everybody else just feels like a lot of, it feels like a heavy burden, you know, in a world where like we're born into this world without knowing much at all. And a lot of what we think we know, we get from people around us. So that was for me what kind of became impossible over time.
Yeah. It speaks to this larger macro issue of indoctrination. Like we all come from parents, and if our parents are one way, the odds are, at least for a certain part of our lives, we're going to just follow it. You know, it happens with baseball. If your dad's a Mets fan, you're going to be a Mets fan. And so you clearly had the intellectual curiosity and the desire to accept others. But I think, unfortunately, a lot of our problems today in society, in our culture, is that there aren't people with those tools or those qualities, and they just continue this cycle of indoctrination and intolerance and lack of acceptance, and it grows into this sense of other. And we're seeing that today in such a toxic tribal way, whether it's with religion or with politics. Do you feel lucky that you were able to have certain influences? I mean, your grandfather sounds like an incredible guy, and to have that pillar in your life that stood for something that was so contrasting of how you were raised, from him to just your own sense of curiosity and wanting to learn about others and accept that not everybody's going to believe the same thing. Do you feel lucky that was your journey?
Yes. I mean, I think I'm grateful for those influences and perspectives. Sometimes I am a little jealous of people who are able to be very comfortable in their lane and say, like, this is what I believe. And, you know, I think, like, that sounds very peaceful to be like so. But then I don't know if people really are. I don't know the insides of people's heads. So I don't know if they're really that confident in their particular beliefs. And there are people who have, like, there are plenty of people, and this is where I'm trying to go, I think, in my own life, is who do have a religious tradition or a spiritual sensibility or whatever you may call it, but who are able to hold that, like, with more of an open hand and with an inclusion of other people. And I think that is, like, a more complex kind of thinking that's required. Mm-hmm. And so that's, like, kind of something that I've had to develop. But I also want to say, like, and we're not saying that you're doing this, but I think that there can be a tendency for people to whom this all seems incredibly obvious. Like, well, you know, there are people that think that religion is just dumb, or that, like, how could anyone believe that stuff? It's so obviously stupid and cruel. But I think, like, I think the appeal of it for people is, and I just say this because I think the more we understand about each other, the more sort of empathetic we can be. And hopefully, well, I used to think maybe we could talk across divides. I don't know if that's possible, but I still am, like, maybe naively optimistic that we can. And so I guess I would just explain that way of thinking in the following way, which is, I think that people who are drawn to really rigid belief systems are afraid of chaos and afraid of everything sort of falling apart. And I mean, if you think about an abandoned house, right? Like, what happens if you don't have structure and intentionality and maintenance? Like, it falls apart. Like, the weeds grow up, the cracks grow up through the sidewalk, the chimney falls off, bats move in. It's not good. And I think that there are people for whom, like, having a rigid religious belief system worldview provides that kind of structure that is necessary to mitigate against the chaos. And in a way, I am sympathetic to that, because I have a really strong belief that, like, you know, we have only so much time on this earth, and we should try to make the most of it. And for some people, being very religious is a way of helping them get out of bed every morning, set intentions. Mm-hmm. But, like, for other people, it ends up being, I think, destructive, and destructive to community, and destructive to that empathy we're talking about. But, like, I'm sympathetic to the desire for some kind of order and some kind of way of making sense of it all, because, you know, entropy is a real thing, and everything without structure and organization and discipline, everything does kind of tend toward chaos. But, you know, I think there are different ways to get at that sort of, everything is a balance too. Mm-hmm. And and jumping too quickly to a rigid order starts to move into authoritarianism really quickly, and people get excluded and people get oppressed, and mm-hmm. not just by religion, but religion obviously has been a tool for that throughout the world, throughout history. So I don't know if that makes sense, but I think that is sort of what's in the back of a lot of people's minds when they go, I have to latch onto this belief system that provides a coherent explanation of the world and vision for how to move through it.
Yeah, and that makes total sense. You know, my personal issue has always been with hypocrisy and the weaponization of religion and doing really bad things under the cloak of God. And, you know, you write in your book about how you became an Episcopalian because you wanted to be part of a church that was more accepting of the LGBTQ community. And, like, so I never had an issue with the stuff you're talking about, like with structure and order, and people should be free to believe in what they want and whatever gets them out of bed in the morning. I just question when it's used in not a good way. Like when you see protests at gay marriage rallies and there's like a little kid and he's holding a sign that says God hates, and then, you know, the bad word for gays. Now, you know, this little kid, this is not his or her ideology. This is coming from parents. And, you know, harkening back to the question I asked you, like, I wonder, will that child one day look at that sign and go, wait a second, this doesn't make sense, and this is not nice, you know? Or is that child, unlike you, going to continue to follow in this path of rigidity to the point of it being extremism and really unacceptable behavior, you know, especially when it's so indoctrinated into children at a very young age?
And there is such a spectrum. I mean, those signs you mentioned, I associate them with the Westboro Baptist Church Kansas, mm-hmm. which was not more than a couple, 3 hours maybe from where I grew up in Kansas City. And, you know, to be fair, like my parents were very critical of Westboro. They thought mm-hmm. that they were hateful.
Oh, as I'm sure a lot of religious people were, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And they weirdly, bizarrely, they came and protested outside of one of my, I was part of a community chorus in mm-hmm. Kansas City my senior year of high school. So it was like a bunch of kids from all over. And they came and protested at our choral performance. And I remember my dad being like, that is really weird, and that gives Christians a bad name. Now, he believed that homosexuality was a sin, but he didn't agree with holding up a sign like that, you know? And so there is a spectrum with all of these things. And, you know, interestingly, one of the, a couple, I think, of the offspring of that group, including Megan Phelps Roper, who is the granddaughter of the founder, and a couple of others who were, I think, tied to that family, have publicly left over the years and had their own, you know, deconstruction, which I'm sure was much more difficult than mine because of how extreme that particular church was and is.
Mm-hmm. So the term evangelical is so ubiquitous, and especially today, it's often referred to in such a pejorative way. Yet I suspect most people have no idea what it really means. So what does evangelical mean? And what's the major difference between that and like mainstream Protestantism?
Mm-hmm. I mean, all of these categories are somewhat murky and arbitrary and contested by religion scholars and pollsters and demographers and journalists. And so, again, there's a spectrum of belief. And, you know, some people talk about what's the difference between fundamentalism and evangelicalism. And, you know, I'm not a religion scholar, but generally when I'm talking about evangelicalism, and I think when pollsters are talking about it too, because we have to sort of create categories for people with the understanding that those categories do overlap and cross-pollinate to some extent, I'm talking about theologically conservative Protestant Christians. So people who are not Catholic, and when I say theologically conservative, they tend to have a literalistic view of the Bible, tend to believe it's sort of directly inspired by God and is true without error and is a guide for life. And again, a really strong belief in the importance of a conversion experience, accepting Jesus and then sharing one's faith. That's where the, you know, evangelical and evangelism come from, the same root. Now, historically, evangelicalism has meant different things and has involved different movements. And it wasn't always the Republican right-wing political movement that it's associated with today. I mean, there is a history of evangelical opposition to slavery. for example, although there were people who would be, many people who would be characterized as evangelicals who also supported slavery, the Southern Baptist Convention was created because of a split in the church over slavery. And it, the Southern Baptist Church originally was the segregationist and pro-slavery church. Now, SBC has since apologized for that and I think tried to move on from that, but that is part of its history. But, you know, in the, since basically the late 70s, early 80s, we've seen a deepening alignment between a sort of Christian right political project that is, you know, aligned with the Republican Party, opposed to abortion, opposed to same-sex marriage, now, you know, fights around book bans and transgender care have sort of been, have become part of that milieu as well. And so, you know, you have to talk about, are you talking about the theological movement or the political movement and the overlap between the two? And then, of course, race comes into it, because often when we're talking about evangelicals, we're really talking about white evangelicals. There are plenty of Black Christians, Latino Christians, and others who have similar theological views to white evangelicals, but they tend to vote differently. They tend to emphasize different things, and particularly Black churches and white churches have, you know, historically been pretty separate. And you know, there have been efforts to mitigate that and to bring more diversity to white evangelical churches, but you know, and they've been successful or unsuccessful to varying degrees. But I put white evangelical in the subtitle of my book because when we're talking about the political piece, it's very, very different, of course, along racial lines.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the political piece, how do you help someone like me and a lot of other people out there who don't really understand the evangelical world, this undying support and religious fealty, in a way, to Donald Trump, who on any conceivable level does not deserve that, and to the contrary, lives his life and does things and says things which completely go against the teachings of Jesus, the teachings of God, religious principles. Help us understand how they can be totally fine with it and excuse it.
You know, it was interesting to watch it all unfold, because when I was covering the 2016 campaign, I think everyone was waiting for that moment when the evangelical movement, leadership, and so forth would break with Trump for those reasons. I mean, I write about remembering very well the Clinton Lewinsky era in the 90s and the, you know, the calls by evangelical leaders like James Dobson, the founder of Focus on the Family, and others for, you know, prioritizing moral character and the need for our president to exemplify that. And so, and I was not the only person to point this out, but I remembered it so well. And then to see the increasing alignment with Trump and the, you know, I remember, you know, in the primary, there were evangelicals who were supporting, you know, like Ted Cruz or Ben Carson or Marco Rubio. But gradually, as those candidates fell away, everyone really kind of came around to Trump. And some, like Jerry Falwell Jr., endorsed him early on in the primary season. But, you know, by the summer, by the time Trump was the presumptive nominee, it was really clear that evangelicals were, for the most part, not going to break with him. And people would tell me things when I was on the campaign trail, like, you know, I don't like the way he tweets. I don't know what his heart is. You know, he's not necessarily someone that I agree with on everything, but it's a binary choice. It's a choice between someone who, Hillary Clinton, who will not align with my goals. You know, I want to overturn Roe v. Wade. I want conservatives on the Supreme Court, and Trump will do that. And so, you know, it's a lesser of two evils. I hear things along those lines. We heard prominent evangelical leaders say things like, you know, we need a politician, not a pastor. Everybody's a sinner. I'm a sinner. James Dobson said, I'm a sinner too. Tony Perkins said, everybody gets a mulligan. Everybody gets another try. So there were all of these sort of efforts to, if not repair his image, sort of say that it didn't matter so much because, you know, the objective was political and pragmatic. Mm-hmm. And so we saw that sort of coming to terms, whatever you want to call it, with Trump from the evangelical community. 80% of white evangelicals vote for him in 2016 and again in 2020. And I thought it was fascinating this time around because, once again, there was a big primary with a lot of candidates, you know, some of whom had evangelical bona fides, or at least, you know, their policies were aligned with things that evangelicals wanted. They were all pretty anti-abortion. And yet, even with a big pool of options, once again, a majority of evangelicals in states like South Carolina and Iowa voted for Trump. And I think that's because they see him as someone who will deliver on their goals. They see him as someone who has delivered for them in big ways, you know, the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And they think he'll do it again. And the other thing is, I think for some, his maybe not his moral character, but certainly his personality is actually an asset. Like, I talked to a pastor in Iowa, actually a state lawmaker in Iowa, who was also, I believe, a pastor and certainly an evangelical, who said, yeah, he's a fighter. You know, that brash personality is an asset. We need somebody in this political arena who will fight for us. And so they see him as somebody who will go to bat for them. And so fundamentally, I think his character is not the primary concern.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because I used to think of the MAGA world as a cult, and it's starting to seem more and more to me like a religion. And I'm wondering from your perspective, if for the evangelicals, if he has transcended his status as a candidate into one that's more of a religious figure. Like, there's this messianic aspect to him. He's like the second coming. I mean, I've heard people talk about, you know, him in that way. And that's really bizarre, because that's taken us to a whole new place.
You do see those themes. He has shared in recent weeks on Truth Social, you know, the image of the drawing of him in the courtroom next to Jesus. I think it was a message from a supporter who sort of compared him to Christ. He talks about being persecuted, which, of course, is a word that has deep, deep meaning in Christianity. And, you know, in the Bible, Jesus said that, you know, they hated you, they hated me, they will hate you too. There's talk about being persecuted for righteousness' sake. Of course, the way that that persecution narrative works is that if your life is hard and people don't like you, you're being persecuted for righteousness' sake. If your life is going well, you're being blessed by God and having God's favor. So you really cannot lose in either direction. That's the way that can operate. And so we're seeing those themes. I will say, I have talked to some evangelicals who are concerned about this. Another pastor that I talked to was from the sort of Pentecostal tradition, which is very, this is another pastor in Iowa, very sort of emotional, experiential, a belief in a really direct kind of communication with God, and often a lot of emphasis on prophecy, apocalypse, these kinds of themes. And he said to me that he was, you know, he's a Republican, I believe, but concerned about this, he used the word messianic, imagery around Trump. And this idea that, you know, he said, that means something to me, that idea of the Messiah. And that means something, and particularly in my tradition. And I'm concerned when I see people, you know, saying that, sort of using prophetic language to say that Trump's been chosen by God. He's kind of this messianic figure, you know, that shouldn't be applied to a human. So I have heard those kinds of concerns, and I've heard concerns from others that it's sort of creating division in churches. But I think that the exit polls that we see and the polling that we see indicates that still, you know, most white evangelicals are pretty firmly in Trump's camp. They see him as their best bet, and sometimes even more than that.
So certainly you don't see there's any kind of tipping point at this point, but do you see in the near or even longer term movement sort of coming full circle and getting back to more of its roots and away from this false prophecy worship of a character like Trump? Or is it just going to keep going further and further into this abyss?
I really don't know what happens long term. I can't predict. I mean, experts I talk to, people who are like sociologists and others who pay attention to these spaces and looking at data, what seems to be happening is that there's the polarization we're seeing across the board is happening in churches. There seems to be an intensifying alignment between the Republican Party and white evangelicalism. It seems that more and more people who those who two ideas are becoming more and more synonymous in a lot of people's minds. Like, there's some evidence that people have come in to a white evangelical identity because they like Trump, even as others are leaving because they don't. And so I don't know where it goes ultimately. One thing that's worth remembering is that the overall trajectory is, while this has stabilized a bit in recent years in evangelicalism, interestingly, the overall trajectory for evangelicalism, white evangelicalism, and really American Christianity as a whole is downward. Mm-hmm. White Christians are a shrinking part of the population. They're a shrinking part of the electorate. And that will likely have implications over the long term. You know, the fastest growth in religious categorization is among people who say they're nothing at all.
Right.
And a lot of those people, if you look into the data like I do, say that they left their religious spaces because they don't like the way their churches talk about LGBTQ people. That's mm-hmm. a big one. White evangelicals in particular are likely to say that staying in those spaces was detrimental to their mental health. Mm-hmm. And so there's just a lot of shifting that's happening. People mm-hmm. coming in, people going out, people leaving their religious identity. But it's not totally clear to me how you, like, not me, but, or you, but how one would harness that.
Right.
White evangelicals are still very likely to vote. They participate at a high rate. It seems like people who have disaffiliated from religion are maybe less politically engaged. Maybe they're burnout on the whole thing. I don't know. So I think that's going to be one of the challenges for political strategists and people who do that kind of work, is to figure out, like, you know, who do you mobilize and how? Mm-hmm. Because the Christian right is really, really good at mobilizing their voters.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure. Looking back on your life, how do you reconcile this particular chapter? Do you feel it was like time lost, in the sense of, like, you missed out on things that other kids, other teenagers, other college kids experienced when they were not as tethered to such an extremist ideology? Or you look at it like, this is just who I am. It's part of my past, part of my truth. It's made me who I am today. And you don't look back in any negative way on it.
I think the older I get, the more it's the latter. Mm. I mean, I didn't raise my children the way I was raised. I made intentional choices to be different. But I there are things, you know, when I talk about them in the book, that were very painful and I think harmful. But I also think that it did make me who I am in some ways I'm very proud of. And, you know, I think that fundamentally anybody who goes through a shift like this, it has to find a way to be at peace with their whole self mm-hmm. and their whole life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me to say that was all bad and terrible, I mean, first of all, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Like, I was very fortunate. My parents provided me a very, you know, I had all of my material needs met, and that is more than a lot of people have. They were trying to do their best. I think they were shaped by the influences they had around them. And so, and therefore so was I. But I think, you know, the older I get, the more I'm just kind of like, well, this is my life. And I've tried to make the best of it, and I have a really good life. And if I can use religious language, I feel incredibly blessed.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've lived a courageous life, I think, to come out the way you have and write this book at this particular time in history is very courageous. And this has been a fascinating conversation because it's a fascinating subject. And the book, again, is The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Sarah, continue good fortune with the book, and I hope we'll get a chance to talk again soon.
Yeah, thanks so much for the great conversation. Good to talk to you, Andy.
All righty. Bye-bye. This episode of The Back Room was edited and produced by me, Andy Ostroy. It was co-edited and co-produced by Maddie Rosenberg and co-produced by Jen Hamoud. Our theme song was composed by Andrew Hollander, and our logo was designed by Cricket Langell. And special thanks to Patricia Wind. Please take a moment to rate and review the podcast, and also follow or subscribe. Until next time, keep your eyes on Washington, Hollywood, and your own backyards, and have a great week.